Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sangkhang namassami. Some time ago, I think it might have been at Berkeley, last week, I was relaying a story, an experience I had when I was a monk at Dao Dam with one of my teachers. This is many years ago. And Dao Dam is a forest monastery. It's very remote, and it's kind of high up in the mountains, and on this particular day, we just finished having tea, the Sangha, the community. And the sun had fallen and it was dark, or the sun was falling, it was getting dark. And all the monks and novices had gone back to their kind of dwelling places. And I was kind of engaged in a conversation with this senior monk, a very dear elder. And as the sun was falling and the sounds of the cicadas and the crickets and the various insects was kind of growing outside, this was in a little sala, kind of an open-walled sala without any walls, just a roof, and there was a little partition between the area where we had tea, and I was talking with the senior monk, and the kitchen area where the anagarikas or novices would prepare tea. And I was chatting with the senior monk, and it was getting darker and darker. And we quite lost ourselves in conversation. It got so dark that it was difficult to see each other. And as we were talking, the novice was still in the other, like in the kitchen area, kind of puttering around and cleaning up after tea. And then at some point in the conversation, he just kind of emerged into the main area where the Ajahn and myself were talking. And he brought with him a candle, one of these kind of large Thai candles that are quite kind of large. And he placed it down by the Ajahn and myself and just kind of walked away very quietly. And the Ajahn just kind of nodded, kind of recognized it, but he didn't say thank you or anything like that. And it was very, really beautiful because after the novice had gone away, I looked in the Ajahn's eyes and there were tears welling up in his eyes. And he just looked at me in sort of this look of amazement and said, isn't monastic life absolutely wonderful? And he was referring to this act of kindness of the novice who simply noticed that our conversation had carried on to the point where it was dark and he brought out a candle for us. And the Ajahn was reflecting on this and he says, it's just marvelous, it's so wonderful. And then meanwhile, I couldn't help, he said it in a state of utter candidness and sincerity, he very unselfconscious. And I was, meanwhile, reflecting on it from the standpoint of, isn't it wonderful that the Ajahn would notice such an act? And the whole thing just seemed exquisite, like the kindness of a junior member doing a very wonderful deed for a senior member, and then the sensitivity and thoughtfulness of the senior member who's actually recognizing that. And very on a very heartfelt level, responding. And I just, you know, I nodded my head in agreement. I said, "Yes, monastic life is very wonderful indeed." So I was reflecting on the Berkeley tea time discussion that I had when I was at Berkeley with Ajahn Karunadamo, and he gave a talk there at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, And before the talk, we have a little tea session, and there's often questions and answers and discussion on Dhamma. And there was a question from one of the people there was about relating to elders and how frustrating it is to be in a position where you're trying to kind of respect the elders and to be kind to the elders and to be thoughtful in this way and that way. But then the elder is, sometimes it feels like very much maybe taking advantage of that kindness. And how do you deal with it? Like, let's say you're in a situation with, you have, you know, parents who are kind of just refuse to listen and kind of bossy and kind of demanding and controlling. And how do you relate to that situation? You want to be kind, you want to be generous, you want to serve, and they just seem to be controlling and manipulative. What do you do? Of course, I don't have the answer to that. That's something, you know, every situation will have its nuances that have to be taken into account, and it's difficult to give a general answer. So I responded. I can't remember what exactly how I responded, but on the way home I was reflecting on it, and I was thinking, you know, it really is true. I think it's a very wonderful relationship, the relationship between, say, in Thailand, on so many levels, like, say, the relationship between children and their parents, and their grandparents, for instance, this willingness to serve and to look after and to care for and to give to, say, on behalf of the children, you give to the parents, for instance. And this is spoken of a lot in Thailand, you know, the need to respect the elders. But maybe what's not spoken of sometimes so much, or especially maybe these days, is I think it's a very fair thing to say that the elders have to respect the dignity of the children and respect that good deeds that are done, on, say, by the children, and kind gestures and so forth, comes from their own virtuousness and their own goodness. And that the elder, you know, that they have their own responsibilities as well. The responsibility of being open-minded, of being grateful, appreciating the good deeds that come from the children or grandchildren. And essentially sort of not expecting to be treated with this sort of incredible kindness that you see for example, what comes to mind in the northeast of Thailand, this sort of kind, giving qualities. And when you have these two sides functioning well, you know, the junior striving to serve the elder, and then the elder striving to respect the dignity of the junior, what you have, in my opinion, is a model human relationship of mutual looking after each other in a very beautiful way. I remember there was this monk, I think his name is Ajahn Tongjun. I'm not sure if I get his name correct, but he's a monk from Isan. I think he's from Ubon. The very kind of northeast of Thailand, which is very less developed than the rest of Thailand, and although it's developing now these days. And he's, again, one of these monks who's been in robes since he was a very young boy, and he's very close with Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Jayasaro. And Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Jayasaro would invite him to come by Wat Banana Chat in Thailand once every year, a couple of years. And he would come by and talk to the community. And I just remember he was a very good storyteller, and he would sit down with all the kind of Sangha members and talk about his family and what it was like growing up. And it was quite common for him, in Thailand, in the Northeast, for children to bathe their parents, to massage their feet in the evening, to bow three times to the parents before they go to bed. All these different little traditions that they do, and whenever they leave their parents, they ask forgiveness from their parents. These little things that come to my mind. It strikes me as very beautiful. And it's something you don't see in the West very much. So another, what this makes me think of, or what this connects to, how will I say this? I'll introduce it by saying, as a monastic, we get asked all the time, very frequently, by lay people, why did you become a monk? And very often you hear the response, you know, it's varied, but it's, well, to be free of suffering, or want to serve, do something for the benefit of all sentient beings, or to liberate myself and others from delusion, and so forth. Very noble aspirations and ideals. And no doubt, I think that's a large part of what motivates us to be here. But an answer that you seldom hear, and it's a bit strange actually, is I just want to be happy. And monastic life is a very rewarding lifestyle. And I suppose the reason you don't hear it so often is because it just doesn't sound as impressive or sophisticated as I want to be free of delusion, or I want to help the world be free from suffering. But I think this is something to take into account, the way that the monastic life is structured. It's a very beautiful life. And for one who is sensitive to the way it's structured, the relationships, the environment, the culture of simplicity and reflectiveness, it seems to me quite clear that this is a very, for such a person, this is a very rewarding lifestyle and very fulfilling. And sometimes it's good to take this into account, because we can sometimes take our life as monastics very seriously, or as practitioners, and we can get very intent on kind of overcoming the defilements and somehow getting just very serious and kind of working ourselves up into knots, and forgetting that actually a great deal of what we're trying to do in this lifestyle is simply be content. You know, it's just about a large part of it is just about learning how to relax. Learning how to let go of the past, to let go of anxieties, and just be able to settle down into a very quiet sense of well-being. So I think, although it's a legitimate, perfectly legitimate intention, is to be inspired by the monastic life, or say the life of a practitioner, in such a way that you want to undertake the practice simply to be happy. This should be given sort of allowance for, and just that much is enough to kind of embark on the journey and to say go forth. And to take the initial steps into monastic life or the life of a practitioner. But I think it would be a shame indeed if that was where one stopped and one didn't go further. We have such a wealth of teachings available to us. And in the teachings, it's spoken of frequently how there are stages on the path. Stages on the path from where we are to the realization of full enlightenment. There's certain stages that we have to go through. And the introductory stage, or the first stage that we have to work with, is developing the quality of virtue, and developing the quality of goodness and kindness. And something I was saying just, I think it was yesterday, actually at tea time, a couple days ago. One of the things I found frustrating growing up in the religion that I did was that although there was a fair amount of emphasis on, say, developing good qualities and being a good boy and obeying the rules and so forth, I was never told how to do that. And I think I wanted to be good. I, you know, I didn't quite know exactly what that meant, but I wanted to be good. There was something in that that my heart connected with for sure. But I didn't know how to do it. And, you know, I'd kind of put forth effort in this way and that way, and time and again, actually, there was a feeling of frustration because I would break the rules and do something I wasn't supposed to do, and I'd feel quite a bit of frustration and even despair over the fact that I don't know how to do this. I can't, something seems wrong with me. I can't seem to be as good as I'd like to be, or certainly not as good as other people would like me to be. And when kind of asking the authorities, why should I be good? I think generally the answer I would get is because I told you so, I told you to. Or because it's what I said, it's what God said, it's what God told you to do. Just be good. In other words, just obey. And I think it's that notion of just obeying which I found so unacceptable. And the two things that I think we have in Buddhism is we have a rationale, we have an explanation as to why we should develop virtue, and we have a very clear path, a very clear teaching on how to do that and what that entails. So this first path, this first sort of step on the path, the cultivation of virtue, it's good to be clear why we have to develop that in our path. And it's actually a very simple answer, because by failing in this step of virtue, it entwines the heart into confusion and turmoil. You just have to look around at people that you know who don't keep any kind of sila, you know, people who consume drugs or alcohol, or who take no thought about sort of abusing other people verbally, or, you know, even worse, physically. People who kind of take advantage of others, people who cheat in various ways. I mean, it's very easy to imagine their hearts as being one which is closed in on itself and doesn't know how to really be with other people, doesn't know how to open the heart to other people. And that comes from a sort of selfishness is at the base of that. And this is, I think, the first step in developing virtue, is to realize that, well, it's for our own sake that we're going to develop virtue. It's for our own ability to have an experience where we can really share space with other people. The heart, which is constantly trying to get something for itself, doesn't know how to open and share with others. Doesn't know how to actually open the heart to other beings. And the other thing that's kind of interesting, say, for instance, sometimes, especially when people come to the monastery for the first time, or, say, junior monastics or anagarikas, I think it's a very common experience that there's this kind of great determination to kind of conquer certain problems that they have and to failings they have in virtue that they're going to kind of beat, and there's this great determination. And it's not uncommon that you see this kind of this sort of attitude to be quite frustrating and often not successful in the long run. And I think what's behind that sometimes is simply this whole notion that we simply have to obey in the same way that we were taught in Christianity, that we were just supposed to obey God. There's some kind of notion that we're just supposed to come up with some ideal and then we're supposed to obey ourselves. It's all about control. We think that simply by issuing a statement to ourselves that we should do something, that therefore we should be able to do it. And that's not the case. That's not the case at all. If we are going to change, if we are going to grow, it really involves a very kind of in-depth investigation and understanding. A good example of this is around food, for instance. Sometimes people, you know, they're just determined, you know, monastics, they're just determined they're not going to overeat. And they come up with 1,001 strategies to make sure that they kind of don't eat too much. And it can be kind of, frankly, and I say this having been there myself, somewhat comical, not to be dismissive of anyone who's going through that experience, but just how serious we can take something like eating, such a simple, ordinary activity, and kind of work it up into a massive problem. And I think one of the reasons why there's often this pain and this frustration around food is simply we think that we should be able to tell ourselves that we won't overeat and somehow that's going to solve the problem. When really the problem is that we have an underlying perception that that food is worth indulging in. And as long as that perception is there on a deep level, no amount of control is gonna solve the problem. You've got to, you know, fundamentally access that perception and work with that. And realize that food, like any pleasure, overindulged in, leads to a sense of dullness and regret. And if you don't see that, then this, you kind of go over it and over it again and again, sometimes for years, and feel like, you know, you're never gonna kind of conquer this. And I think, you know, at the same time, so someone says, so what am I supposed to do? Just kind of sit down and just, you know, if I don't have these kind of skillful means, I'll just overeat. And well, the answer is no. That's true. You have to just work with this. You know, you have to constantly do your best to kind of find skillful means to not overeat. And the reason you have to do that is because if you don't, like you said, you'll suffer the consequences and you'll regret it. So you have to do what you have to do in order not to overeat. But at the same time, you have to recognize that skillful means and tricks won't solve the problem. So it's really about investigating and not controlling. There's a wonderful quote in the suttas that the Buddha has. He says that there's two kinds of happiness. There's the happiness of sensuality, and there's the happiness of renunciation. And he says that the happiness of renunciation is the higher of the two. And I love that quote, and I always have ever since I first read it. And it applies on so many different levels, both in the sense of going forth into homelessness, both in the sense of renouncing coarser pleasures actually opens one up to more refined pleasures. I think, for example, living in a forest. What an exquisite sort of environment to live in. And living in a forest is possible through renunciation. You know, you think of the Buddha's days, renunciation meant just renouncing and just kind of wandering off into the forest, you know, and just living there, sitting under a tree. There's this one sutta, I can't remember exactly how it's described, but there's this monk and he's gone alms round, he's received what the sutta says is a delicious meal. He ate neither too much nor too little. Having done that, he washed his bowl. He went to the foot of a tree. He sat down for the day's abiding and dwelt in peace and equanimity. And I just think about that image, and that's, to me, the image of renunciation. The beauty of a forest is what you get when you renounce the life in the city. So the beauty of a natural environment. So on the level for monastic or for practitioner, the cultivating of sila is just so important. It's such an important foundation. And what it leads us naturally into is a much deeper sense of well-being, and that comes from samadhi, from stillness of the heart. And again, stillness of the heart, it's if you have been cultivating actions which, say, involve breaking the precepts, it's very likely that the heart is really seeking out those experiences, intense experiences. It's seeking for intensity as opposed to clarity. It's seeking passion as opposed to peace. And when it comes to sit down in meditation, the happiness of stillness will be unavailable to it. One of the reasons why, put this a point I've made many times, but one of the reasons why samadhi is so important, stillness is so important, is that without an experience of the happiness of stillness, it's very easy to, when we reflect on where this path is going, we reflect on what does renunciation mean. Sometimes it can arouse a certain sense of anxiety. You know, do I really want to renounce everything? You know, is that really fulfilling? To be simply still? I mean, is that what I want? Is that, you know, is that what I was born for? Is that really serving the world? Is that really wholesome? To be free from rebirth. I mean, this is one way the goal is described. I mean, do I want that? Do I want to be, you know, it sounds like annihilation. It sounds like nothingness. And we experience in the experience of samadhi or stillness in meditation, it gives us an experiential sense that it's all right to let things cease, and it's all right to experience renunciation. That before we experienced the happiness of stillness, there might have been great anxiety around letting things go. The various attachments that we might have, I mean, it's quite challenging to let them go. And when we experience stillness, there's a sense that it's all right. It's all right to let things end. It's really not a problem. And that's why stillness is an important foundation for insight. Because without that experience of letting things end, there's a great anxiety around things like death. Or letting go of, say, deep attachments, loved ones, careers, things like that. And I think that's one of the things that we're aiming for in this life is sort of that realization that it's all right. You know, these things are just so much a natural part of nature, and this is what beings, human or otherwise, have gone through since time immemorial, you know. The experience of letting things end. We come into this world and we have a body, we have a family, we have a culture, an environment, and that's necessarily going to pass. And that's not a problem at all. It's really not. And you can say that, and I mean, again, it's not one of these things just like trying to change your behavior. It's not one of those things you can just tell yourself and then you'll believe. It's something you have to really settle into. So I thought tonight I would just say a few words on, you know, just to sum up here, just what a beautiful relationship it is that can be created between an elder and a junior. And, or to that same extent, between the lay community and the monastic community. It's a parallel relationship. And it's a foundation for a kind of harmony, which if both sides are, as it were, doing their duty, is something that can be really rejoiced in, by both sides. And it's using that rejoicing, that appreciation, which helps to open the heart, and helps to develop a sense of appreciation for what this life is all about. When I say this life, I don't mean monastic life. I mean the life of a Buddhist, be it a layperson or a monastic. That relationship is really one which requires that both sides be sensitive to the other. That the monastic be sensitive to the layperson, and how difficult it is to make offerings and to give to the monastic community. I mean, this is a great challenge. The Buddha says this is one of the things that is not easy to do in the world, and that's support a monastic. So it's something that monastics have to be sensitive to. And lay people to be sensitive to the needs of a monastic community. Food, just enough food to live on, really, is all we need. Shelter, clothing, and medicine. And it's through that relationship that we develop it, and we develop it, and we care for it, and we nurture it, and we reflect on it, we go over it. How are we relating to the other side? Are we doing so in a beautiful way? Are we doing so in a way that will increase wholesome mental states, both for ourselves and for the other side? It's this sort of relationship where we should kind of develop the perception that we're like one. We're one organism. And we grow in dependence on the other. And that's a real foundation for well-being. And well-being is the foundation for stillness, for the peace of meditation. And the peace of meditation and the stillness of meditation is a foundation for the realization that it's okay to let things get still. That's really okay. And we don't constantly have to be trying to control, trying to fix things, try to know. We don't have to know how things are going to be, how things are going to turn out. So much of our life is immersed in not knowing. We don't know what's going to happen. And we have to learn how to, you know, really accept that. That's okay. It's okay not to know. So I'll conclude with one last comment. I was hoping to include this earlier in the talk, but I'll just append it here. Just the skillful means that I've used both just in general in developing a sense of contentment. And this is going to sound corny, so you have to excuse me, but to literally count, to go through, and you can do this in meditation or when you're lying in bed or driving a car, to literally count all the things that you're taking for granted. You know, and really try and just go through the numbers. Like 1, 2, 3. You know, there's your health, there's your friendships, your family, the various, you know, insights that you've had into life. This is something no one can take away from you. Every noble thought you've ever had, no one can take that away from you. Every kind intention, every generous act, no one can take that away from you. That's there. And if you're fortunate enough to have that in your past, that's something not to take for granted. That's something that is quite rare. And if you're somebody who doesn't have that in their past, then you can reflect that you have the knowledge that I hope you take away from this talk, that you have the knowledge that that's a meaningful thing to develop, the virtue and the generosity and the sensitivity to others. And just notice how, you know, let's say you're lying in bed and you're kind of on one of those restless nights and kind of turning back and forth, or your meditation just doesn't seem to be going anywhere and you can't settle down. Just notice what it does, how effective it is in brightening the heart and putting a different spin on everything. So tonight is going to be a short talk. And I think I'll leave it there and offer these words for your reflection.